Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show.
Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, and radio TV personality dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills.
She also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you,
the listening audience.
Now let's join Donna and her guests.
Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo. I'm delighted to be with you. And if you have had an interest in archaeology, if you've wondered whatever went on in America, what ancient peoples were here, if you've come across information about the Snake Mounds or the old Indian dwellings and artifacts that have been found in the Four Corners and various other parts of the United States, and you wondered, is there more? Well, you're going to find out that there really is a lot more than you ever imagined. The United States has had so many cultures for millions of years that actually have lived in this country, and we're just now really becoming aware of what is in the past. And boy, it's going to change history books like you would not believe. My guest today is Frank Joseph. We're going to be talking about the lost worlds of ancient America, lost technologies, and a little bit more. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Donna. It's great being here.
Now, I'm sure many of my listeners are familiar with you. If not, you were and have become been the editor-in-chief of a magazine called Ancient American. You've published 20 books. You absolutely have a passion for history. Where do you think this passion came from? Did you have a mom that liked to go digging for artifacts out in her backyard? I mean, how did you come about this?
No, Mom was a tremendous musician, and she gave me that gift. But as far as interest in the past, in the history, I think it was a number of factors. But the most important thing, I think, was a feeling of inadequacy with my education. When I went to the university, I went to Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, Southern Illinois, and I felt that their explanations of the past were inadequate. For example, we were told that for all of our history, we were a rather primitive creature and didn't really do much. And then all of a sudden, 5,000 years ago, we started inventing and building pyramids. We had written languages. We had governments and organized religion. Just went overnight like that, nothing mm-hmm. before. And then we were told also that this process of sudden birth took place in isolated places, either in the Nile Valley and in the Valley of Mexico and India, all simultaneously, and people just started to do it. I thought, no, I think that there were some precursors going on. I think it takes a long time to invent these things. You just don't think them up. And so one thing led to another, and I began traveling and found out that there is a completely hidden history to our continent, a totally, well, as the title of our book says, a lost world, lost worlds, plural, that has been either ignored or just neglected, and that it's an incredibly rich prehistory, that civilization has risen and fallen on our continent several times, mm-hmm. and that the Statue of Liberty represents a melting pot. But thousands of years before that statue was erected, there were peoples from many other parts of the world that came here and did fabulous things, and that's what we're trying to do, is to reconstruct the greatness, the lost story, the lost dramas of these peoples.
Now, your book is broken down into a number of different stories. You've had different people contribute as researchers, and you have a number of your own articles in here. And you have it broken down into physical proof, sites, ancient American high tech, and foreigners in prehistoric America. And I know in the research that I have read about, it just absolutely delights me to find that they are actually acknowledging now, with a great deal of difficulty, that people were traveling around the world a long time ago. that Columbus wasn't the one that discovered America. As far as the Europeans go, maybe that's the case. But there were a lot of people here for a long, long time. And the Chinese, and there were just so many. The Vikings, there's so many different cultures that were very mobile. And this is something that now is coming to the forefront, and I wonder how long is it going to take before the schools catch up with this and really look at history with an eye of enthusiasm, because there's so much richness to discover. Let's start off in Los Angeles. The very first segment that you have in your book, you call it California's Buried Altar and Monument to the Great Flood. We've all heard about the Great Flood. There isn't a country in the world that doesn't have a story of some kind regarding this phenomenal global experience of this tremendous flood. Tell us what was discovered in L.A.
Right. It's a marvelous discovery. It took place only about 15 years ago. There was a couple in Los Angeles County that were enlarging their basement. They were digging further down to put in a water heater or something like that. These were ordinary Americans, no particular interest in the past. And as they dug down deeper, they were maybe about 12 feet below the surface of the ground. And they dug out a cube, a stone cube, obviously man-made, crafted, and it had on the front of it various design motifs, and the most remarkable was that of the bas-relief of a woman, her face protruding from the stone, and around her was a stylized hairdo. And they had no idea what this could possibly be, so they took it to the Los Angeles County Museum, and the archaeologists there could not deny that this was a real artifact. It wasn't a fake, and that the dirt and the deposition on the stone showed that it had been in the earth for a very long time. They were just guessing. They said, well, it's got to be more than 500 years old. Well, it was more than. I think what they were saying is that it was buried before modern Europeans arrived here.
Mm-hmm.
They could not associate it with any known North American Indian tribe at all, none in California. They were never, the Native Americans were a people always on the move. They lived very close to nature, but they didn't build stone monuments like this, and certainly this didn't resemble anything at all ever found in North America. And so man and woman who found this stone contacted us, and our researchers went to work on it, and we were able to discover that the motif that is portrayed, and especially the woman that is depicted,
mm-hmm.
Matches exactly a Phoenician goddess by the name of Astarte. And Astarte was a Phoenician goddess that was worshipped about 3,000 years ago. She had many different attributes associated with her, and one of them was that she was a goddess of travelers, far travelers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that worked.
The Lady of the Sea, I believe you called it in your
book. That's what they called her. The Lady of the Sea was far travelers or sailors, and it turns out what this object is known by archaeologists as a tophet, T-H-O-P-H-E-T, which is a specific type of altar that was used by the Phoenicians. So as incredible as it is, nonetheless, this is hard physical evidence that the Phoenicians arrived in California, of all places. They sailed around the Cape of Good Hope. They arrived in California, and they were here for whatever purposes we don't know, but nonetheless, they established themselves here. The interesting thing, I think, that our book does, and I really only realized this after it was published, not while we were putting it together, is that these monuments, in many cases that were left behind, that are being found now, imply a very powerful spirituality. That one of the causes, it would appear now, why these people came here was to spread, proselytize, or be missionaries for spiritual ideas, which are encoded rather obviously in some of these monuments. And the spiritual impact that was made on prehistoric America began to influence Native American thought, and we're able to now trace back some of the Native American Indian spiritual views to traces from overseas. So it isn't just that they came here as castaways or were here for purely economic reasons.
Right.
They made an impact that was far beyond their time, not just in the monuments, which we can admire and wonder at, but that the Native Americans, bless their hearts, the Native Americans actually carried forward some of these ancient ideas. And I think that's the thrilling part of it, is that the spiritual impact on prehistoric America is the most lasting and overall the most important.
Food. There isn't a culture in history that hasn't been concerned about food. If you don't have food, you can't live, you can't eat. Food, water, mobility, being able, if you have surplus of food, then to be able to sell your surplus. In every culture that has ever been very successful, no matter what time in history it's been, they've always had a good agricultural base that is absolutely paramount. They're able to feed themselves, and then they have surplus, they can sell it to other people. I was really intrigued with your chapter by Wayne May on the ancient Egyptians coming to America for corn. And the first sentence of that chapter, you say, 21 golden corn cobs will change everything that has been written about the discovery of America. And this was stated by an anthropologist, Gunnar Thompson. And I said, this is so wonderful because it shows the international trade that was done centuries ago. Tell us what he found out.
Well, I'm so glad you brought up that little chapter. It's just absolutely what Gunnar Thompson says. Gunnar Thompson, for those of our listeners not familiar with this man, he's not only a PhD, he's a renowned anthropologist. The only difference between him and his colleagues is that he has enough courage to come out in public and say that this information is now part of the proofs of the contacts between North America and the ancient world. And this particular subject is so important because for 2 years, Dr. Thompson investigated a rather peculiar motif that he found at a temple in Upper Egypt. It is a temple belonging to Queen Hatshepsut. Queen Hatshepsut ruled 1,500 years before Christ, 3,500 years ago. She was the leader of Egypt at a time when that civilization was very prosperous, and she dispatched an expedition, an overseas expedition. All this is recorded in the Egyptian records, the Egyptian hieroglyphs, at her temple and in the Nile Valley. And the expedition went to a place called Punt, P-U-N-T. Nobody knows where Punt is. Nobody knows what the Egyptians were referring to. They just described it as a very rich place far away. And on the sides of this temple, where she describes, her scribes have written about this expedition to Punt that took place so long ago, there are portrayals of stevedores carrying various riches from this wonderful site. And among the portrayals of the riches being brought back to Egypt from Punt, it shows a servant, several servants, carrying these trays. And on these trays are representations of maize or corn cobs. And Dr. Thompson wanted to see if there was a resemblance at all between the portrayal of these corn cobs and anything in North America. It was a very accurate, vivid one. Thousands of people have seen this temple, have probably walked right past this temple frieze. And after 2 years and working with paleobiologists, he was able to affirm beyond a shadow of a doubt that the corn cobs portrayed on Queen Hatshepsut's temple are, in fact, North American corn cobs grown exclusively here in North America, not grown in Egypt or North Africa, and they could have only been brought back to Egypt from North America. The land of Punt, he has established now, was, in fact, North America. The Egyptians came here to North America specifically for this type of food. So that's remarkable. I mean, it's hard evidence that shows that they were here for food, as you say.
I was intrigued with how it was discovered that this was called barbarian corn. I just chuckled when I heard that because I think how many times have we said, oh, these people are barbarians. Look at what the Spaniards did when they came into the New World, and
yeah,
everybody else was barbaric. They brought in disease and destroyed and murdered, and you know, just it was incredible without even taking the time to recognize that they were the barbarians, not the individuals that they were coming in contact with. I find human history intriguing, especially the more that I become aware of it and the consistent pattern of repetition. If the generations, there's the old saying, if you don't learn from the past, you're doomed to repeat it. And it is a very valid saying, because without education, without understanding what the possibilities are, without exploration, without having records of the past, you do go in, for all intents and purposes, into a level of the Dark Ages. And it's occurred on so and during mankind's history on this planet, which I just find really intriguing. Let's pop forward to Bolivia. Now, Bolivia, you have an article by J.M. Allen, and he is, or was, a air photo interpreter for Britain's Royal Air Force.
Right, Mr. Allen was a leading expert in the Royal Air Force. He was an officer in the Royal Air Force, and he was an expert, an authority, leading authority. He worked for the United States Air Force, because he was an interpreter of photographic imagery. He was in charge of a photographic squadron in the RAF. And so his job for many years was to be able to determine what photographs, aerial photographs, sometimes taken as high as 30 or 40,000 feet, what they're showing. Are you really looking at natural features? His first job was to determine if something that they were showing was a natural feature or a man-made feature. And that was really important, because his aerial photography of Bolivia showed what he thought possibly might be man-made canals as opposed to natural features. Well, most archaeologists said, oh, you're just looking at natural features that kind of resemble that. But this man has the expertise. He has over a decade of experience in determination between an artificial formation and a man-made one. And after surveying these photographs that he made of the Altiplano in Bolivia, he was able to determine that what they were revealing was an enormous irrigation network that went back many thousands of years. And if there is anybody in the world that would be able to make this determination, it was Mr. Allen. And his article is to the effect that he believes that people from the irrigationists from the lost civilization of Atlantis are the only ones that really could have been capable of this type of irrigation network. Not only were they capable of it, this irrigation network that he was able to find parallels very closely the description by Plato of the irrigation systems that were used by the Atlanteans. So he makes a very interesting case for that. If anybody else had said this, you'd think like, well, it's kind of fantasy. But when you're dealing with an authority like this, it's pretty hard to just dismiss it.
I think one of the points that he brings out in his article in your book, The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, is the fact that this is a volcanic area. And to quote from his article, he concluded that the entire continent of Atlantis did not sink in the sea, but only the region surrounding the capital city, which was built on a volcanic island in the center of the plain. It could have only been South America, and it fits Plato's description, and he said it disappeared. It just, as has happened historically in many places, there are islands, because of volcanic eruptions, they've risen up, they've gone down under the sea, and that is what he felt was there. But he also said there were metals there that were mentioned by Plato. Everything is, they have been able to verify much of what he has discussed, and they found an island volcano inside of the center of the plain, 5 miles from the sea. And this is amazing to me. Without technology, we wouldn't know this. We wouldn't be able to see it. And as our technologies become more sophisticated, I think of Edgar Cayce, who had mentioned many years before he passed away, that this is what was going to happen. We were going to be finding Atlantis, finding out more about it, finding out about so many things in the world, because we had the capability of discovering it. And I just think it's marvelous when we are able to bring forth information. It does challenge the norm. It does. It puts a lot of flies into the ointment of perception that has been carried around for a long time. But I say, fine, get out the fly swatter, get rid of the flies, get rid of the other stuff, let's clean the things up and let's look at the facts. This is wonderful. This is exciting.
Well, it should be. I think you put your finger on it earlier when you said that history is, in effect, you were saying it's a great object lesson, but history is something that is not just dead and in the past. It releases energies and forces that are still interpenetrating our own lives and existences and will go on. There's a momentum in history. It's like the flow of the past, which is really not distinct from what's going on now. And the only way for us to really understand our place in the world and to understand what's happening to us now is to understand what happened before that led up to what's going on now. And these energies built up a momentum over thousands of years. They're not just lost in the past. They're really alive now. That's the real value, I think, of history.
I thoroughly enjoy all of these different people that you have brought together in your book from all over the world. One is Professor Nobuhiro Yoshida, and you have his article on American and Japanese dragons. I think this is marvelous. It enables us to cross culture boundaries that really should be disintegrated. And it is just marvelous to show how we really all connect in ways that we would never, ever have imagined. And this article is on American and Japanese dragons and the correlation between the two different countries and this artwork, the Piazzu of Alton, Illinois. And if I didn't pronounce that correctly, please advise me.
Yeah, Yona, you did. That's correct. The Piazzu.
It's beautiful. I mean, this is an exquisite drawing. And then you have the picture of the Japanese dragon. That's another thing in your book. All of these wonderful photographs that you have and illustrations that complement these articles. They're just great. So talk about Professor Yoshida.
Professor Yoshida is the leading scientist in Japan today. He's probably the best-known scientist. He has an international reputation. He has many presentations he makes in China and Europe and so forth. And Professor Yoshida was intrigued about the comparison between Japanese dragons as they're portrayed on the mostly Shinto temples in Japan, which he was very familiar with, as everybody in Japan is. And he happened to see a representation one time while visiting the United States of something called the Piazzu bird. And the Piazzu is this marvelous painting of all things, high up on a cliff on the Mississippi River on the Illinois side, not far from a little town called Alton. And it was discovered by Father Marquette in the 17th century. He was, of course, one of the first modern Europeans to negotiate the Mississippi River. And he describes the Piazzu in his diaries, his logbooks of this expedition that he was on. The Piazzu is really a kind of a dragon. It's an unusual creature, has the body of a lion, has the wings of an eagle, it would appear, has a serpent's tail that goes around the body, has a man's head, a bearded head, with a pair of horns. It's really very unlike portrayals of fabulous creatures in most Native American myth. The Native Americans themselves in that area, Mohawk Indians, as a matter of fact, referred to the Piazzu as kind of a foreign concept. What Professor Yoshida was able to do was to compare the Japanese dragons as they're portrayed on these ancient Japanese temples with the Piazzu bird in Illinois and found striking similarities between the two. He also was able to investigate Native American legends associated with the Piazzu bird and found some similarities with Native Japanese traditions. So his article is trying to draw parallels not only between the Japanese dragons and this dragon in Illinois, but also other wonderful parallels. One of the things that is not mentioned in his book, although it supplements it beautifully, is a DNA test that was made of Native Americans living on the west coast of North America, especially the Haida Indians, the Tlingit, and down to the Zuni in the southwest. And these DNA surveys were able to establish genetic traits from Japan going back 20,000 years. That's incredible. But the DNA is unmistakable and has been retested. There are traces in Native American populations today that go back 20,000 years. That's a huge number of years, because we're told in our textbooks that the very first human beings did not arrive in North America until 10 or 12,000 years ago across a land bridge from Siberia.
Well, and that's ridiculous.
This DNA testing is showing these people are not Siberian traces that are showing up. They're traces from Japan. And they go back 20,000 years ago.
Yes.
It's you could write an entire book. It hasn't been written yet. Somebody should do it, which shows the Japanese impact on the Americas. You can prove it genetically. You can prove it culturally. And you can prove it in linguistically. The Zuni Indians, for example, who have these traces of Japanese in their genetic makeup, they have so many cognates. A cognate is a word that's similar to another word in a different language. There's so many cognates linking the Zuni language to Japanese that Japanese tourists can get along speaking the native language of the Zuni Indians. This is something that anthropologists don't like to talk about too much, mainstream conventional scholars, but nonetheless it's true. And you go to a Zuni reservation, if you bring along someone from Japan, they can converse with them. So
that is amazing. And, well, it's not unlike the Cherokee. They had much of the Hebrew language in theirs. There's so many things that go on, but I want to mention something quickly before we run out of time. There's a section, and believe me, those of you that are listening, there are so many points of detail and information in this book, and it is written for the layman to read so you can understand it. It's just marvelous. Genocide in Ancient Kentucky, and I love this story because it talks about how the Shawnees told in 1773 a representative of Lord Dunmore, the governor of colonial Virginia, when he went to visit them, that they were never allowed, you cannot tell you that you're allowed to settle in the Kentucky lands because they never owned the land. It belongs to the murdered ghosts of the murdered Asgins, a white people from the Eastern Sea. And I'm quoting from your book, their bones and their ghosts own and occupy every hill and valley of the country. Long ago, our fathers and our grandfathers killed off the Asgins, but we now fear the spirits of these people more than our fathers and grandfathers feared them when they were flesh. This was in the 1700s, this story was told. And nobody knows how long they had been there, but they found 3-score pit iron furnaces. Then it was long before any of the Western Europeans ever came here in our history books. Iron making was done by them. They had a workforce. I mean, these are a forgotten people. This is all in Kentucky. That's amazing.
It's not only in Kentucky. It's really headquartered primarily in the Ohio Valley. These people call the Asgins. And from there, they spread out to Kentucky and through large parts of the Midwest. Native Americans still remember these people. They have different names for them. One, for example, the Ojibwa refer to these lost white people as the Yom Kodesh. And the Yom Kodesh, it means a people who were as numerous as the prairie grass but no longer exist. There's another name that they have for them, referring to them as the red-haired giant sorcerers. This is Native American tradition. This isn't something that's imposed on them or made up or channeled or anything. This is their own traditions. And archaeologists have admitted the existence of these people. Archaeologists refer to them as the Adena. That's an archaeological term. It refers to a site where this culture was first known. And this white tribe, if you want to call it, they were the first people to introduce agriculture in North America. There was no agriculture before they arrived 3,000 years ago. They were the first iron workers here. They had primitive iron foundries. And the most amazing thing about them is that a number of their individuals were of incredibly tall stature. Several mounds have been excavated in Kentucky and Ohio, Adena mounds, that have revealed the skeletal remains of human beings that were more than 7 feet tall. The tallest one verified so far was 7 feet 8 inches tall. Skeletal remains of those that are 7 feet 2 inches tall are relatively common. Those are all males. The tallest female found so far was 6 feet 9. Also nothing to sneeze at. And these people are apparently, I would say more than apparently, related to the ancient Celts who occupied Western Europe, especially Brittany and the British Isles, at the time of Rome and before. This same people also created stone forts, which still exist today. You can go and see their stone forts all through the Ohio Valley. They still exist. And these stone forts are identical to the stone forts that were made by the Celts. They were known as oppida, referring to these great stone fortifications that were up there. So the Asken, as they're referred to, A-Z-G-E-N, that's one of the names for them, the Yom Kodesh, they had various names. They were also known as the Allegheny. That's a famous name. That's the name
absolutely.
Allegheny means the people of the mountains or the people of the river. And the name Aleg, or Aleg, that is what their name was like. We don't know exactly what they were called. Their name was either Ali or Aleg or Asken, something like that. It sounds like a Celtic name, by the way, a Celtic tribal name. And Gainey refers to the place of. So it would appear that the Celts arrived here about 3,000 years ago. They were getting in trouble with Rome shortly thereafter, so there were additional numbers who arrived here. And they were the introducers of agriculture. They also made stone pyramids. And some
amazing.
Of their some of their pyramids still exist. They were covered with great stone blocks, beautifully fitted blocks. Those blocks were all removed by farmers in the 19th century. But the mounds themselves still exist. They were surrounded by huge moats. The moats were sometimes over 30 feet deep, 75 feet across. I mean, these were people that knew how to build monuments. And the most impressive of all that is that inside one of their monuments was found in West Virginia a tablet. It's called the Grave Creek Tablet. And the Grave Creek Tablet has been verified as a Celtic inscription. We know exactly what it says. And it's marvelous proof, physical proof, that our country was...
It's exciting. It is so exciting. Frank Joseph, it has been absolutely a delight having you as a guest on the show today. His book, The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, it is a compilation of so many different discoveries that have been validated. He has articles in it, a number of people from around the world. It is something that is mesmerizing, and let me tell you, you always have something to talk about at a party. People will just go, what? So you can say, I found it in the Lost Worlds of Ancient America. And go to his website. It is crystalskullsevents.com. That's crystalskulls, with an S, events.com, and you'll find out more information about Frank Joseph, his publications, and so much more. It's been a delight having you as a guest. This is just absolutely a mesmerizing piece of publication, and I'm so delighted you were able to share this time with us. Frank Joseph, this is Donna Sebo. Thank you so much again for being my guest, for taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects?
Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain?
Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have.
Cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toppersen, pain relief and healing cream. Toppersen relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain.
But don't take my word for it.
Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toppersen and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you.
We know you hurt.
We want to help.
We are so sure that Toppersen will work for you.
We offer a money-back guarantee.
So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toppersen.
Toppersen is available at Duane Reade,
Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans.
Ask for Toppersen
or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you.
That's 1-800-959-1007.
Toppersen, the last pain medicine you'll ever need,
and you can sleep on that.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are open. If you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, well, then give me a buzz. 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And all I need is your first name or initial, and then I will tell you something about yourself, what's going on in your life, and a little bit of this and a little bit of that. I wanted to share with you today, I've got some interesting information on some athletes, and I've got a wonderful recipe for a chocolate cake. Yes, I think I've got a fixation with chocolate for a couple of days here, but I wanted to let you know about it because it's so easy and it's just delicious. But I wanted to bring something up. When I was out walking with my little Scotty Victor today, I was noticing all of the beautiful flowers that we have in the Pacific Northwest in our neighborhood. I mean, it's just ablaze with color. I love spring in the Pacific Northwest, and I'm sure you're enjoying it wherever you are. But our lilacs are beginning to come out, and they are so fragrant. Of course, lilacs come in all kinds of shades, and the fragrance will just float through the air, and when you smell it, it's just such an invigorating fragrance. And there are fairs that are going on, and here in Woodland, Washington, we have a lilac garden that is awesome. And it's Hula Klager Lilac Gardens, and they are world renowned for the lilac bushes and trees that they have. And you can go to lilacgardens.com. If you love these fragrant flowers as much as I do, you know that you can practically grow these anywhere. And you can check out on their website, again, lilacgardens.com. And this is a great time if you wanted to put a lilac in your yard, and I suggest you try to find out about the different ones because their fragrances are different, and you may have a preference. And I know we put one in our yard, and it's in a pot, and when it comes out with the warm temperatures as they come about close to summer and during this time of the year, oh, it just is so sweet-smelling in the evening especially. It's just absolutely awesome. And you can order them online. You can check your local nursery. But if you can, when they're in bloom and you see the different types of lilacs, do take the time to smell their fragrance because they are different. But I thought I would just share that with you because they are coming out in abundance here in the Pacific Northwest, and they are just absolutely marvelous. Well, in talking with Frank Joseph about history, I thought I would share a little bit of fact, having just come back from Alaska. One of the biggest events up in Alaska is the Iditarod. And the Iditarod is just a tremendous demonstration of how valuable dogs were and how important sleds were for transportation. Because in the far north, it's very difficult to get from one place to the other very easily. And that was the technology that was most effective. And people sometimes think it dates back a few centuries, the use of dog sleds. And as we know, in remote villages in Alaska, they were used for transporting goods, people. They were used to pick up game that was caught in traps. But when they started doing the archaeological research on this, they found that this has been going on for well over 4,000 years. That's right, a long time. Now, they have an account. It's what they claim is the first account written about the use of a dog sled. And it was in Winnipeg, Manitoba, a race that was done from Winnipeg, Manitoba to St. Paul, Minnesota in the 1850s. And then in 1886, the first St. Paul Winter Carnival featured dog sled races because it was highlighting the winner. And it's really quite exciting when you are involved in these races because it takes a lot of training to get their teams together. And usually you'll have a dog that makes a very good lead dog, and the animals have to work in synchronization, and they each have their own physiological movements, and so you want to balance them. Some are stronger if they're on the left side of the sled. Some are on the right. It's just a real art to getting these animals to move together because they love to run, absolutely love to run. I'll never forget the first time I ever saw sled dogs, and I was up in Fairbanks, Alaska. And when you see them on television, they've got these real thick coats, and you think, oh, these are huge, huge animals. Not really. The sled dogs I saw apparently had been trimmed for summer, and they run them even during the summer to keep them in shape for their winter competition. But they were lean. Their actual body wasn't as big as I thought it was. Their coats are incredible, though. Now, the first major long-haul distance sled dog race in the world, the All-Alaska Sweepstakes, began in 1908, and it was organized by the Nome Kennel Club, and they mushed 408 miles from Nome to Kendall and back. And the Iditarod started in 1973. Now, I thought it was earlier than that, so when I found out the information, I was really surprised. So this all started, the Iditarod started in the 70s, and then the first Yukon Quest International sled dog race started in 1984. Now, they rely on the dog team's strength, endurance against very harsh elements. It can get down to 120 degrees below zero with your wind chill factor. These animals are amazing, and their hearts, their passion for the running is incredible to see. But there's another type of dog racing that evolved that's just as important and as popular. And I had not heard of it. It's called sprint mushing. And they're smaller teams, usually 6 to 10 dogs in harness, dependent on what the specifications are for the race. And they're not going to have to carry food or survival equipment. And the sleds are lighter than the ones that are used for the Iditarod because that's really a long haul. And they just are absolutely all out with a sprint. These dogs just go with the gusto that is unbelievable. They're phenomenal to watch. And they work the dogs quite a bit. They have to run them consistently. And I remember Susan Butcher. She is renowned for winning the Iditarod, and she's just an incredible woman, and her dogs, she just loved them. And she's recognized for her skill and just the graciousness as a woman that she had. But I think that this woman's skill with working with dogs was incredible, and they had to have a tremendous plan for feeding the dogs, training the dogs. It was almost 24/7 to be involved in this kind of an enterprise, and she was very, very good at it. So I had a chance to talk with her husband a few years before she passed away and learned quite a bit about that. A little bit of trivia, and I want to remind you quickly, if you want to call in and chat with me, give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. And for those of you in the Pacific Northwest, the Seattle area, and those areas surrounding it, I'm going to this Saturday on the 12th, I'm going to be doing a class with flower readings. Now, this is something that I don't have the occasion to do very often. It is so much fun. It's $25 for the class. It's being held at the Ascension into Light Foundation. The time will be 1 to 4 on Saturday, and you bring in a flower arrangement. You must choose your flowers, no silk flowers, no artificial flowers, real flowers, plants, whatever it is that you have. And then it'll all be put on a table, and I won't know what belongs to what person, but by golly, I'll give you a reading. And it's, again, it's a lot of fun. It is something that just is amazingly accurate in telling about a person and what is really going on in their lives, et cetera. Plants do reveal that information. Donna Sebo here. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about your back. Dr. Jay Lipoff is going to be my guest, and this is a man that really has a good sense of humor. He's a doctor that has a passion for wellness, wants his patients to feel good about themselves, and that's what we're going to be talking about tomorrow, so I don't think you're going to want to miss that. And then on Friday, we're going to be talking with Rebecca Fannin. We're going to be talking about Asia, China, Could you start a business there? Yes, you could. What are the pitfalls? What are the benefits? Well, we're going to find out from Rebecca, and that's coming up on Friday. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break for just a moment. When we come back, give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. Also have that pad of paper and pen handy because I'm going to share this yummy Mother's Day chocolate cake recipe. Easy to fix and, ooh, good, good, good. Of course it's chocolate. Why wouldn't it be? This is Donna Sebo. We'll be back in just a moment.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Let me share a poem that was sent to me by Sharon. She said, Donna, I think this is the greatest and truest description I've ever heard for a friend. And this is how it reads. Friends, they love you, but they're not your lover. They care for you, but they're not from your family. They're ready to share your pain, but they're not your blood relation. They are friends. A true friend scolds like a dad, cares like a mom, teases like a sister, irritates like a brother, and finally loves you for you. That is friendship. I thought that was a very nice little statement about that, and I think most of us would agree with it. Okay, quick like a bunny, I wanted to share this recipe with you for this chocolate cake. Now, this chocolate recipe came with a story, and it was something that Catherine Slatterly wanted to share with people because she said her mother was a wonderful cook. And one of the things that her mother had as a tradition was the making of this chocolate cake. And people just loved the recipe. So whenever she was asked to go to a potluck or visit a friend for a dinner, they'd say, could you bring the cake? Could you make this cake? And she said, when my mom passed away, that was one of the gifts that she left. And she said we weren't going to be enjoying the wonderful food that she had always fixed for us. But she found this recipe for this chocolate bundt cake. And it's so simple, but let me share it with you. You're going to need a package of Devil's Food chocolate cake mix. And if you like more of the fudgier type chocolate cake mix, I think you could use any of that. But this is how her recipe read. One package of Devil's Food chocolate cake mix, one package of Devil's Food instant pudding mix, and that's instant pudding mix, one package of Devil's Food instant pudding mix, half a cup of oil. She used corn oil. You could use whatever your favorite oil is. Half a cup of water, four extra large fresh eggs, You need 12 ounces of sour cream, one 12-ounce bag of semi-sweet mini chocolate chips. You can add more if you like. But that basically is the recipe. Now, your oven is going to be preheated to 350 degrees. You want to use a non-cooked sticking spray, or if you want regular butter, you want to make sure that your bundt pan is well greased. And you need a good-sized bundt pan, and in a mixing bowl at a medium-high speed, mix together the cake mix, the pudding mix, the corn, oil, the water, eggs, and sour cream. And you just leave it, let that mixer scrape down the sides periodically, but it needs to mix for 10 minutes. And once it's done, then you want to take a large spatula and fold in your chocolate chips. Pour your batter into your prepared pan, and you bake it for 50 minutes or until the toothpick inserted in the center of the cake being baked comes out clean. Now, then you're going to remove the cake, put it on a rack, put a rack over your cake pan, flip the cake out over, and let it cool. And then once it's cooled, you can dust it with confectionery sugar, or if you like chocolate icing, whatever your favorite icing might be, you can do that. You can decorate it. Now, this cake freezes beautifully, and you can freeze it whole, or you can slice it and then freeze the slices, and it's very good for up to 3 months in the freezer. And it serves 12 to 14 people if it lasts a minute after you finish baking it, because I guarantee you it's going to be gone. People are just really, really going to enjoy it. And, oh, does it ever smell good when it's baking? So that is a special Mother's Day recipe from a daughter who has left this legacy and decided that she wanted to share it with everyone. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you want to chat. 888-627-6008. Polo. Now, can you imagine a woman playing polo? This has been a man's sport forever. Well, there was a gal. Her name was Sue Sally Hale. And at the age of 3, she absolutely fell in love with the game of polo. And she decided she was going to play this game. Now, it was against the rules. Girls were just not allowed. And she was born and raised in Southern California. And in the early 1950s, the polo scene, and you can see some of the polo grounds out in Santa Barbara, and there's some other places, I'm sure, but I know of them in Santa Barbara, absolutely forbid women to even come on the field. It was just, no, no, that's male turf. Well, when she had become old enough to play, and of course she did a lot of practicing, she decided she was going to break the rules. And break the rules, she did. She would dress up as a guy. Before each tournament, she would put on a baggy shirt, stuff her hair under her helmet, and draw on a mustache with mascara. Now, it makes you wonder, how in the world did she get away with that? Why didn't she use the theater glue and have a fake mustache that she put on that way? I don't know why she didn't, but apparently it worked. She played under the name of A. Jones. She was so ferocious as a player that when people were commenting on her participation in the game, this is what they would say. They'd say she could ride the horse like a Comanche and hit the ball like a Mack truck. And then this is what she did at the end of the match. She would manage to get away. She would take off the fake mustache made from her mascara pencil. She would take that off, change her clothes, clean up, and then she would go around with the teammates that played with her, and they didn't even know it was her. Makes you wonder how good their observation powers were. But regardless, she just entered in. She just had a good time. She became part of the after party. For 20 years, she was able to keep this scam going. And she campaigned like fury to get the U.S. Polo Association to change its policies and let women in. Finally, in 1972, she received a membership card along with being able to play the game using her real name. An amazing story of a woman that decided she was going to make sure that change was going to be with the game. And I honestly don't know how many women play polo at this time. I always see footage of the guys out there, but I was totally unaware of this incredible woman. So we need to remember that. There's always someone that has opened the pathway for opportunity that has gone before us. This is Donna Sebo. I know that we're just about out of time. Don't forget, tomorrow we're going to be talking about physical wellness, and I invite you to tell your friends and join me in the mornings now from 9 until 10. And it's a delight being with you. I'm so glad you're sharing your time. Remember always that you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. One of the greatest gifts we have as people is to become educated, become aware, be open to learning new things, to be unafraid of the challenges that we face, recognizing that the challenges are there because we have the opportunity to expand into our own personal greatness. Live your life with zest because it is your life. And you have this wonderful gift to give the world, and that is yourself. Give the best of what you have. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. This is Donna Siebel. I'll be back with you right here at VBS Radio, same time, same place. Have a magnificent day or evening, wherever you might be. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.